What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends for another episode. And I've got to tell you, this one is going to turn your hair, if you have it, as white as mine, or make it perhaps as sparse as John's, because what you're about to experience is something that I think a lot of people are going to say, no, this can't be true. No, we could not have made a mistake this large. Oh, by the way, I'm Larry Rifkin. What a mistake. I didn't introduce myself.
Yeah.
John Krofcik.
Hello.
I take it for granted that a lot of people have been listening for a long time.
This is a very good story. I'm glad you got this story up because it's an old story, but it's very, it strikes a note today on some things that are going on that you sort of wonder, you know, if it happened then, could it be happening now?
Well, it is happening now, trust me. But let me tell you how this all came about. First of all, John and I don't have a lot of guests in the studio because, well, this is a national or international podcast. And many of the people we talk to are from all over the country and the world. But sometimes they live in our backyard. And John, let me just tell you how, now this is going to seem roundabout, but I want to explain it. Years and years ago, when I was in public television and I was assessing programming, we used to do a competition here in Connecticut, and it was a film video competition. And a woman who won it one year, her name was Elda Hartley, and she was a remarkable woman from Fairfield County here in Connecticut. And she ran this New Age Film Foundation. She was all into new ways of thinking. And she'd have Gene Houston and Ram Dass and all these big names. Remember the New Age, John?
New Age, yes. Same as the Old Age.
Yeah, I know. Well, but these were thinkers that took us out of our daily experience. And, you know, you had to have a little incense and you had to cross your legs, wear a robe, whatever it may be. But, you know, it was interesting because I didn't know if I could get along with Elda because she won the competition. But then she had an idea. Larry, I'd like to do this documentary called Voices of the New Age. And I said, well, Elda, I don't know if we're going to really be able to work together because at that time she must have been in her 80s.
Wow.
And I said, oh my goodness, is she going to yield or bend to desires that I would have to make this a program that I thought I could distribute nationally for public television? Because I thought maybe she was a little set in her ways. I've got to say this, John, it was one of the most remarkable experiences of my time in public television because she kept giving me rough cut after rough cut after rough cut. And she would respond to any of my criticisms. It was wonderful. She was great to work
with.
That's awesome. So the point of that is don't prejudge what the experience that you might have with another person is going to be like because you just never know.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. We have a tendency to prejudge things and we surprise ourselves sometimes.
Exactly. So be open-minded. So I was glad that I was. But in the course of doing that with Elda Hartley, and she's now deceased, but I ran into the name John White. And so John White is going to be our guest today, but not because he's into noetic sciences or into the New Age thinking, but that is a large part of his experience. I mean, a remarkable man.
He is remarkable.
He really is. Let me just read this. John White is an internationally known author who writes about the human mind and spirituality and their relationship to social and political affairs. He's published 16 books, including The Meeting of Science and Spirit, What is Enlightenment? A Practical Guide to Death and Dying, and for Children, The Christmas Mice. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Reader's Digest, Esquire, on and on it goes. So, you look at it. Now, he's also worked, by the way, with Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell, and they together, John, began the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which is a research organization founded by Dr. Mitchell to study the human potential for personal and planetary transformation. Wow. I mean, remarkable stuff. What a life.
Wow, you're not kidding.
But you and I find him in a totally different place, right?
Way different.
I mean, you can't believe this, folks. We don't make this stuff up. We really don't. So John White, I got to know him through that Elda Hartley project. We had him on the radio program. And just several years ago, he put together a book about another experience, because in addition to all that we've referenced, he was an English teacher in Cheshire, Connecticut. So you say to me, okay, is that the story? No, that's not the story.
That's not the story at all. But he has an amazing life.
Really, when you think about it.
Yeah.
And he was right here recording with us recently. Well, he wrote a book called The Gulf of Tonkin Events, 50 Years Later, A Footnote to the History of the Vietnam War.
And this is an old story, but I still don't believe it to this day. I mean, it's just amazing how this changed everything, and it was all a lie.
Absolutely. The Gulf of Tonkin was a false flag operation. He'll explain what that means. He'll explain how he came into an understanding that the premise upon which we went to war in Vietnam was fallacious, and how, as a result, 58,000 Americans and countless Vietnamese lost their lives. It's really a really tragic tale. It really is.
It is.
And yet we've given up so much to the executive today. And if you want to trace where some of that comes from, you have to go back to the Gulf of Tonkin. And here's a man who is devoted to America, who is patriotic at its core, but he really has concerns about what we have done, how much we have given up to the executive, and whether, in fact, war powers have now been ceded to the president, and they basically have given themselves away in terms of congressional responsibility constitutionally. So you've got to hear this.
You've got to hear this.
It's remarkable. John White, again, the background, we've given it to you. Author of The Gulf of Tonkin Events, 50 Years Later, A Footnote to the History of the Vietnam War. You may not want to know this, but you have to.
You got to listen to this episode. Because,
and it's still relevant today.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, we are at war. We're in so many different places in the world, and you got to wonder why we're some places that we are.
And how are we going to get this back in check?
Right.
Well, forever war, and it started perhaps right here where we begin our story today on America Trends with John White. With us is John White, the author of the book, The Gulf of Tonkin Events, 50 Years Later, A Footnote to the History of the Vietnam War. And John, I think a lot of people will know you for so many things in your life, including the noetic sciences, and know you as really an international figure in that regard. But there you are writing a book about the Gulf of Tonkin. What was it that commanded your involvement in this? And tell us your unique perspective on the Gulf of Tonkin, both the incident and the resolution.
Okay. I became a nuclear weapons officer on a seaplane tender in the Pacific. My job was to load nuclear weapons onto seaplanes to go after Russian or Chinese submarines, if so ordered. This was immediately after the Gulf of Tonkin event on August 4th, 1964, which really marks the beginning of Vietnam as a hot war, because President Johnson and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet all got radio messages from a two-destroyer unit in the Gulf of Tonkin saying, we're maneuvering at high speed to avoid as many as 26 torpedoes from North Vietnamese torpedo boats. And then about an hour and a half after that, the radio message changed. It said, oops, recommend no further action. We're evaluating our equipment and seeing what's going on. What happened was those two ships fell into the illusion of being attacked because of the underwater sonar picture presenting false images. Now, this was an absolutely dark night, and Admiral James Stockdale, who was then a commander and later a friend of mine, flew air cover for those two destroyers off his carrier.
The same gentleman who ran for vice president, correct?
That's correct, and who was the commander-in-chief of all the prisoners of war in the Wallo prison in Hanoi, otherwise known as Hanoi Hilton. Anyhow, he later said, when he got back to the carrier, what's going on there? There was no torpedoes, torpedo boats, no wakes, nothing. So it was a false report which was sent up the chain of command to President Johnson and Robert McNamara. They knew that, but McNamara, or rather Johnson, chose to ignore it so he could go to Congress the next day and report that we, the United States, had been attacked while cruising peacefully on the high seas, and he was taking retaliatory action and had already ordered strikes against North Vietnam. I knew this because, as nuclear weapons officer, it was my responsibility to read the secret messages daily. Well, we got ordered to, my ship, the USS Pine Island, got ordered to South Vietnam, Da Nang, South Vietnam, to set up a seaplane base to load my nukes, if so ordered. We were not so ordered, and 2 weeks later, we went back to normal peacetime steaming. We came back to the to San Diego in late November, more like December, I think, early December. And then a few months later, we went up the coast to the Long Beach Naval Shipyard for normal repairs. And while walking through the shipyard one evening to go to the main gate to see my parents for dinner, I fell in step with a chief sonar man. So we had a way to go. So as we walked along together, we just exchanged pleasantries and information about ourselves. When he told me he was the chief sonar man on the USS Turner Joy, one of the two ships that had allegedly been attacked, I said, "Chief, that's amazing, because the radio messages said there was no attack, and they were reevaluating the underwater picture." He said, "Yes, that's true. I was the one who kept telling the bridge, that is, the controlling the captain on the bridge, that those are not torpedoes. They are false images on the scope." The captain said, "I don't want to hear that." He said it three times. Each time the chief reported those were torpedoes coming at him. And finally, the chief just shut up with a feeling of being rebuked for doing his job. Well, that was an interesting confirmation of what I'd read in the messages. But I was still in the Navy. I had a few months to go before I got out and came back to Connecticut. So I just tucked that information away in the back of my mind. But meanwhile, President Johnson had used that to launch strikes, which had clearly required several weeks prior planning. In other words, the Gulf of Tonkin event was a false flag event. It was a manufactured incident used to justify going to war.
That being a false flag event, yes. What you just described. Yes. And were there people involved, I mean, from the standpoint of those on the ground, who knew that this was the intention of the United States government, at least the president and perhaps the defense secretary, and they were complicit in this as well?
They were, but I didn't learn that until several years later when the Pentagon Papers were published. Daniel Ellsberg reported that on that August 4th event, he was planning in the process of planning wartime events, and that the planning had been going on for quite a while. In other words, President Johnson intended to go to war, but he didn't want that to be known until after he was elected in November of 64. So clearly, the Gulf of Tonkin event was the match which lit the fire that Johnson needed to escalate the war in Southeast Asia, because it certainly went outside the borders of Vietnam.
And we can get into the rationale and why you feel it was that he was determined to go to war. But then we see that Congress had a vote on a resolution, and they passed it 99, I believe, to 1. And it was Wayne Morse from Oregon who, in fact, not only voted against it, but inspired you to do something in relation to this that had great impact for now the civilian John White. But do you think anybody in Congress, I mean, were they complicit, or did they know that this was a false flag event?
Well, first, I'll clarify. The Gulf of Tonkin resolution was presented by President Johnson when he reported to Congress on August 5th, and his staff had written it up weeks earlier. In hindsight, he was simply looking for an opportunity to stampede Congress to rally around the flag and pass this document, which gave him unlimited authority to wage war in Southeast Asia. I knew about that, but I was brand new as a teacher at Cheshire High School
in
Connecticut, my hometown in Connecticut, and a young father and husband just trying to settle in and live a quiet civilian life as part of a peace machine, which is what I consider education to be, rather than the war machine. But as the war ramped up really, really quickly over the next 2 years, the casualties killed in action rose from 400 to more than 20,000 in just 2 years. I was struggling inwardly about what to do with the knowledge I had, because the whole war was based on the authority given to Johnson by the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and I knew that resolution was based on a lie. So finally, one evening I heard Senator Wayne Morse, the lone dissenter from the resolution, say, "President Johnson has replaced the Constitution with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution." And that really clarified things for me, because I'm regard myself as a patriot. I revere the Constitution and want to see the United States of America preserve our constitutional way of life. And it was clear that if I went public with this knowledge, I would be open to charges of treason, because treason is defined in the Constitution as giving aid and comfort to the enemy. And if I told people that the Gulf of Tonkin was phony, that certainly would be considered traitorous. And as a fact, it was, because finally that led me to write a letter to the editor of the New Haven Register and charge President Johnson and the Joint Chiefs of Staff with giving false information to Congress. And I cited the two sources of information, or knowledge rather, the reading the secret classified messages and talking to the chief sonar man on one of the two ships. Well, that letter was published on December 6th, 1967, and it set off a firestorm in my own life.
And John, you were the first person then to question whether this was a legitimate response to a provocation that was real and unprovoked by the Americans, or not made out of whole cloth. You were the first one.
I think so. There may have been others who came forward quietly, because Senator Fulbright requested me to come to Congress and talk about this, but he told me that or his aide told me that I was not the only one who came forward. I was simply very public about it, and it just upset my life for about 3 months with all the news media hounding me for statements and interviews. It was not just a national sensation. It was an international sensation because crews, TV crews from Japan and the Netherlands came over to interview me. And even the Soviet foreign war journal or something like that had a story about John White confessing that the Gulf of Tonkin event never happened.
Well, you know, if that happened today, John, people would say, you know, Donald Trump would be tweeting about you and discrediting you and trying to really make hash out of your story. Did the Johnson administration ever attack you?
Not publicly. Behind scenes, there were shenanigans. When I finally located the missing chief sonar man, he told me that at the time he was in a Norfolk Naval Hospital and received a phone call from an admiral in the Pentagon, which he took in the office of the hospital commandant. The admiral asked him a simple question: do you know John White? Now, we had had just a chance meeting, a very brief duration, and he was recovering from something, I don't know what, but he thought, did not recognize my name and said, no, sir, I don't know him. And that concluded the interview. But he said he came away with a feeling that if he had said, I do know him, he would have been in deep trouble. As it happened, immediately after discharge from the hospital, he was sent to a destroyer in the Black Sea, where he was, in effect, incommunicado during the time Senator Fulbright had his Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearings on the Gulf of Tonkin. And Senator Fulbright had asked for the roster of ship's personnel from those two ships, which were provided. But a reporter a few years later found out that those rosters had been scrubbed of certain names, including the chief sonarman's name. Fulbright couldn't have located him, no way, no how. So there was dirty work afoot in the Pentagon against John White because of what it meant for President Johnson's authority and credibility.
It's remarkable that a citizen like yourself could have really provoked all of this activity, but you couldn't stand by and watch thousands upon thousands of American soldiers, going to their death in something that seemed illegitimate and something that was manufactured. So that's really what drove you, did it not?
It was an act of conscience. I was wrestling inwardly with the mounting death toll. Some of them were my buddies, and I didn't want to see my buddies come back in body bags. Finally, Senator Morse's comment crystallized my thinking, and I felt I had to go public with my knowledge.
And John White, when you look at it, I mean, the U.S. has not formally declared war since World War II. And let's talk about the Constitution. Under Article 1, Section 8, Congress has sole power to declare war and grant letters of marque and reprisal. But Article 2, Section 2 provides that the president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the U.S. What was the intention, as you see it, of the framers? And how much have we deviated from that and still to this day are deviating from that and sending young men and women out to war?
I think there's been great deviation from the Constitution. We, as you said, we have not declared a war since World War II. In fact, not only Korea, but also the war in Southeast Asia were conducted under United Nations auspices. We were acting as a proxy for the United Nations. I see America as deviating badly from the Constitution, but in sinister and covert ways that are not easily recognized. Our military is being used to build an empire abroad rather than protect the republic we're supposed to be. So I take, with regard to my Vietnam activities, I was anti-war after it became clear to me what was going on, but I was never anti-military. I never turned my back on the guys over there. They had my full support and my heartfelt thanks, and the military today still does. I thank God for the courageous men and women who volunteer to serve in the military, but I object to the foreign policy which sends them into harm's way, and the reasons for it seem to be largely commercial have little to do with the actual threat to America or the defense of America. Just for example, George Bush went into the second Iraq war, claiming that Saddam Hussein had nuclear materials and that he was strongly in league with Al-Qaeda. And so we could expect, because of that, we Americans could expect to see a nuclear cloud over America from a terrorist nuclear bomb smuggled in here and detonated. Well, as a former nuclear weapons officer, I know these things up close and personal, and I did not want to see that. So I gave George W. Bush, my support to go to war, and even spoke at a rally in support of that right at the beginning of the war. Several years later, it became, oops, we didn't find any nuclear materials or weapons of mass destruction, and I felt snookered again. But we were there for reasons which are hard to identify, but largely commercial.
Well, do you think that Congress has got to reassert itself in this process? And when you see the fact that there are many congressmen and senators saying today that the president cannot go to Africa and parts unknown, deploy these troops without the Congress being aware of this, and we still using back to 2001, 9/11, the Iraq War, still using that authorization of the use of force as the legitimate reason that he can do this unilaterally. What do you think about that when you see that going on?
I have mixed feelings. Larry, before the war with Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden was a friend of America. The CIA was training him and his people. We created the terrorist threat, which eventually blew back on us. And why did we do that? It was part of the Cold War with the Soviet Union. But even that Cold War with the Soviet Union had a lot of traffic and commercial intercourse between the commercial and industrial elements of both sides. It seems to me that a handful of super rich people have used an interlocking directorate of their companies and corporations to steer the foreign policy of America into a state of perpetual warfare, which, of course, is good for business if you're in the defense industry. But I don't regard that as right and proper nor constitutionally justified. War, the declaration of war, is what is constitutionally needed.
And going back to Vietnam, and then we'll go forward again, Do you feel that it was all about commercial interests, or was it about this domino effect and the concerns that Russia really was going to overrun major portions of Asia? But how did you tie that together with the commercial interests as you now look back?
In my research, I found that in the early 50s, a study was given to the State Department from the Council on Foreign Relations saying that their research showed that, commercially speaking, America should maintain hegemony in Southeast Asia because it was a good market for us and also a source of raw materials. We needed to stay number one, according to the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, the Council on Foreign Relations has been cited in recent years on television where the talking heads say it's a nonpartisan think tank, but nothing could be farther from the truth. It really is a front for what's been called the New World Order and has gained deep control of the State Department and has been influencing State Department foreign policy for decades now. So the domino theory was operating in parallel with that, and it first became public with under President Eisenhower, a president I respect. I had to wrestle with that in my mind as I was engaged in going public and later anti-war activities. But I decided, on the basis of my reading, research, and personal experience, that the Vietnam situation was essentially a civil war and that America had no business or moral right to be engaged in a civil war. We should have pulled out and left Vietnam to settle itself, because later it became clear that there was no falling of country after country in Southeast Asia. They were all trying to protect their own sovereignty and individuality. And it was neither Russia nor China that overran Southeast Asia.
Congress has the power of the purse. And yet, when you look at it, I'm really wondering how you feel as somebody who's been in the military, somebody who looks at these issues very seriously. I just read there's a new study that the U.S. has spent $5.6 trillion on wars in the Middle East and Asia since 2001. And the Pentagon has this narrow estimate of 1.5 million. So just a vast disparity, about three times. I mean, Congress seems to be abdicating its responsibility in a host of ways, and it seems as if the American public has also been removed from the process through their representatives of really engaging about the appropriateness of a lot of this action. It seems as if we're not really yielding our boys and girls to the military. People are volunteering, and most of us are off to the side looking at this as a professional army. How do you look at these developments?
Well, I repeat, I'm very grateful for the men and women who volunteer to wear the uniform of the U.S. military, and I have the utmost respect for them. But like a lot of civilians, they've been snookered. They have been, in effect, brainwashed to think that when they're deployed to the Middle East, it's defending America. I don't see it that way. I see it as defending a hidden empire, which is under control of a plutocracy, a corporatocracy. And although we still have elections, we no longer have representative government. Congress is largely in the pocket of its donors, and I'll say this for President Trump. He doesn't view things that way. He respects the military, that's clear. But he sees also how America's independence and sovereignty has been underridden by a host of international treaties and agreements and things which reduce our sovereignty, our independence, and our treasury, because we're funding an awful lot of activity in the name of the UN.
Which of the treaty obligations that we have now, of course, as we are recording this, he is over in Asia. We have obviously security alliance there. We have security alliance with the Europeans. Which do you consider to be part of a serious and necessary national security?
First, I'll say that NATO is hollow. Trump is challenging that, but I would prefer to see us get out altogether because it's costing us a large amount of treasure, and it's also under the auspices or under the ultimate control of the United Nations, which does not represent America. It's a forum for hundreds of anti-American countries and figures to attack and disparage America. The America I know and love is a sovereign, independent state which has a strong military to defend us, but does not go abroad seeking to generate wars. And that seems to have been the action of the CIA, especially in over the last few decades. We generated the terrorist threat that we're facing today. And even ISIS was generated by a foreign policy which was intended first to take out the president of Syria, Assad. And a vacuum of power there allowed ISIS to grow rapidly and take over the region. So now we're fighting our way back. When I say our way, I mean Iraq's way, but with the help of America.
Do you feel that it's unfair that many young people are not involved in the military today and really have no relationship to it? If you think about somebody who's college educated here in New England, where we're broadcasting from, I mean, there's virtually no one in the military, and they're coming from different kinds of poor backgrounds and those who are in the South and the Midwest. How do you look upon service, or are you concerned that maybe so many of the ways that they're being deployed are not terribly legitimate, and therefore you want to sculpt as many young people away from the military at this moment in time until that balance is restored? What do you think about that?
Okay, I do not turn my back on the military per se. I repeat, America needs a strong military to defend itself against many forces acting hostily to us in the world. And I would encourage young people to volunteer. Military service is an experience that profoundly molds one's character and outlook and patriotism. But even though you're in the military, you have a duty as a citizen to examine what's happening in your name in Congress, not just in the military, but in Congress. You are a citizen soldier, the term George Washington used when he gave his farewell address, I believe, saying commerce with all, treaties with none, in effect. I'm paraphrasing him. I believe that our young people should have a period of service. If there were a constitutional amendment saying everyone between 18 and 26 must spend 2 years in some form of service to the federal government, and it were constitutionally approved, then there would be buy-in from the American public and young people would have an opportunity to serve, perhaps in the military, perhaps in a medical corps, perhaps in some environmental situation. Service to America is what is needed, And the service off the military offers that, but we've got to clean up our foreign policy.
What do you see from Congress right now? I mean, do you see them reasserting themselves in any way? They don't seem to want to vote again on the use of the authorization of force, even though the one that goes back to 2001 seems a bit dated, given where we are around the world today in 170 nations. And this incident in Niger is bringing that to people's attention once again. What's your take on Congress at this moment in terms of reasserting itself?
I think it's sort of weak and spineless. It doesn't follow the Constitution as I understand it. And it's divided by a lot of commercial interests and donor interests. I'm sorry, I don't feel competent to comment on the 2001, what is that? The term
authorization for the use of force.
On the use of force, I don't feel competent to comment on that. But there can be a clear and present danger in which it's right for the president to take unilateral action before going to Congress, but should report to Congress immediately thereafter.
Well, let me go back to 1973 and the war that so concerned you at the time, of course, and this whole notion of the War Powers Act, giving the president more flexibility, yet making certain that they then report back to Congress on this. Do you think the War Powers Act should be reexamined in terms of its constitutional fealty?
I do indeed, yes. It should be full examination of that, because this is just one other area in which we have drifted away from the Constitution and enlarged the federal government in areas where it's not authorized to act.
You have a senator who hails from your hometown of Cheshire, Connecticut. Do you talk to him? I'm talking about U.S. Senator Chris Murphy, about these issues.
I do not. I've tried a few times by communicating with him by mail and email, never got a response. We sat together on a reviewing stand one Memorial Day parade. So I like Chris, but his politics and political views are not wholly congruent with my own.
What do you think about sequestration and trying to force the military into more of a box, if you will, by virtue of authorization of funding?
I'm frankly undecided about that.
Do you see anyone in Congress? I mean, when you look at John McCain, and he has slammed the administration for failing to articulate a strategy for Afghanistan, what do you think the president or any president owes Congress in terms of explanation and clarity in terms of the use of force and why we're still persisting in various situations around the world?
I want to see greater exchange of views between the president and Congress. I want especially to have the public informed and waked up to what's going on. From my point of view, Congress is weak and spineless. It's in the hands of various private power groups, and not performed their responsibilities as elected representatives of the American people.
Do you think we have an unchecked war on terror today?
Unchecked. What do you mean by unchecked?
That it just will go on forever, needs no further clarification, needs no further authorization, just to continue. And if you call something terror, that American use of force is appropriate without congressional intervention.
I think the world is seeing the emergence of a global terrorist threat. its numbers are small in comparison to the men and women of goodwill in countries all around the world. But we cannot relax our vigilance and lower our guard. So it's necessary for our military to take action, which is dictated first by the president and the foreign policy he seeks to implement. But we've already gotten into a situation of what seems like endless war before the terrorist threat. And it's a very perplexing and confusing situation, Larry, in which I do not claim to have any totally perfect answer. I trust that President Trump and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the intelligence community are acting in our best interests as defined by the Constitution. I trust that is going on. But there's an element of doubt about it all. And even there, I don't claim to have any firm source of knowledge of what's going on.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time and will lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends. Well, John White, the author of the book, The Gulf of Tonkin Events, 50 Years Later, A Footnote to the History of the Vietnam War. I want to thank you so much for joining us on America Trends Podcast today as we talked about that incident and where the war powers assertion of the executive branch has gone since then. I thank you so much for coming by today. Thanks for listening to this episode of America Trends.